Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. According to new data, prisoners in Michigan serve longer sentences than in any other state. That's on top of the fact that Michigan has not overhauled its sentencing guidelines for 15 years. We dig deeper into what's behind prison sentences coming up on today's show. And then, as Detroit faces bankruptcy, a deal has been struck to build a new sports arena in the city's downtown. We'll find out if that's really what Detroit needs right now. But first, where were you 10 years ago when the power died? That's what a lot of us in the Midwest are asking each other today. It was 10 years ago this day when the largest blackout in North America left 55 million people in 8 states and Canada in the dark. The cost of that blackout of 2003? Well, it depends on who you talk to, anywhere from $4 to $10 billion. Well, that left us wondering, what changes have been made to the grid in that decade? And could a blackout like that happen again? Maggie Kurth-Baker is a science columnist for the New York Times Magazine, and she's a science editor at BoingBoing.net and the author of Before the Lights Go Out. Maggie joins us now from Minneapolis. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, I'm going back 10 years in my own mind, and I distinctly remember standing outside my dentist's office in Huntington Woods in Oakland County. The blackout hit, and people were coming down from the buildings and standing outside, and there was a real tense, worried feel. And it was clear from what people were saying, they were worried that this was a terrorist attack because we were coming up on the two-year anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Do you remember that fear?
I definitely remember that fear. I was living in Kansas at the time, so we weren't actually affected by the blackout where I was. But I remember people talking about that. I remember people being really concerned about that.
But really, take us back. What actually triggered that great blackout?
Well, there's a couple of things. You know, there's on the one hand, there's stuff that's extremely technologically complicated that has to do with how our grid works behind the scenes and the stuff that we don't see about, you know, how our world works every day. And then there's stuff that's so incredibly simple that you're just going to laugh when you find out about this. Tree trimming.
Tree trimming
was actually a major part of why that blackout happened.
So it began in Ohio, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Explain what happened.
So what happened was that when you are running electricity over an electric wire, that wire gets hot, and that heat starts to make the wire more flexible, and so the wire kind of starts to droop. Now, if you don't have your trees trimmed back well enough, that wire can droop into a tree, which then triggers an electric short. And then what has to happen is the electricity that would have flowed along that wire kind of has to shift in a way and start flowing along a different wire so it can still get to where it needs to go. But then you're adding more electricity to that other wire, which is making it hotter, which is making it droop more, which means that it's more likely to hit a tree also. And so the more of these wires that you have drooping and shorting out and rerouting the electricity flow, the more that the wires that are left over get hotter and droopier and are also more likely to short out. And what happened was that you had this cascade of electrical wires that just started shorting one after the other because the electric company that owned that right-of-way hadn't done their tree trimming properly.
Boy, so it really was a very low-techy cause of all of this.
Yeah, that was really one of the things. But there was other stuff going on behind the scenes that I think is really interesting, and it had to do with why we weren't able to stop this cascade before it became such a big deal.
All right.
And that has to do with, you know, the way that the grid works. And right now, the electric grid, we have these people that work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, monitoring this grid on a second-by-second basis. You know, you have to pay really close attention to this. And I think it's something that people don't really realize very often. I like to say that the grid is a lot like a lazy river at a water park. It's a circuit.
Okay.
You have to have that complete circuit. And likewise, you have to have the electricity that moves along it has to move along at a constant speed, which is analogous to frequency. And it has to move along at a constant depth. That's analogous to voltage. And how you maintain that constant speed and constant depth is by maintaining this almost perfect balance between electric supply and electric demand. And when that gets out of whack by even fractions of a percent, what you get are blackouts.
There you go. So it's a very delicate balancing act.
Oh, it's an incredibly delicate balancing act. But the problem is that in 2003, the people who were in charge of maintaining that balancing act weren't getting information updated quickly enough. So if you have a power plant go offline in Arizona, you can see the effect of that in Canada in less than a second.
Wow.
It's extremely quickly. But in 2003, the people who were maintaining the grid only got updated on the information every 30 seconds.
So it was coming from First Energy in Ohio. It just exploded across those eight states in Canada, probably before people even had any idea what was happening.
Yeah, and what they found when they've gone back and done scenarios, essentially replaying the entire thing virtually, is that there were signals happening, you know, hours before the electricity actually went off, that if we'd been able to see those signals, we'd have been able to stop it. But nobody was getting the information that they needed to get at the right time in the right way, and it just enabled this really simple tree trimming problem to get really out of control.
So we're looking at a low-tech thing like tree trimming. We're looking at lack of communications. And as you write in your piece on BoingBoing.net, a small series of mistakes turns into a catastrophe.
Right.
What has happened in that 10 years to keep that from repeating itself so we don't get an encore?
Well, the fines have gone up for tree trimming, so there's that. But there's also been a lot of work done in that situational awareness and making sure that the grid controllers can see that big picture a little bit better than they could before. So I told you that in 2003, there was a 30-second delay on how often that big picture got updated. Today, that's down to 10 seconds. And it's still not fast enough, but it's much faster, and it could catch things that we couldn't catch 10 years ago. And that largely has to do with these little things called phasor measurement units. And they're really boring. They're, you know, anonymous technology in a server farm somewhere that you never see and that you'll never think about. But basically, they enable those people to see that big picture and get updated on it in a much faster way. So they actually know what's happening in more places, at more times, and with, you know, just a better view of the entire situation.
So we've got kind of an awareness, maybe we not as the consuming public, but the folks who are running our power companies, that was a wake-up call with these phasor measurement units, then these PMUs.
Yeah, there's been kind of a big push to roll those out. We had 200 of them on the electric grid in 2003, and by the end of this year, there'll be about 1,000 of them.
What about looking ahead? Our infrastructure it's not young now. It's only going to be aging out as we look down the road. What's being done to kind of be ahead of this?
Not enough is the short answer. Right now, particularly when you're talking about the electric grid that happens in your community. So there's really two different levels of the electric grid. You have the transmission grid, which is how you get electricity across states, across continents. And you have the distribution grid, which is what happens when it gets to your neighborhood, your town, and how it gets from house to house. And that distribution network is really old, and it's not necessarily in great shape. So you have these little substation transformers, which, you know, if you look out your window and you see those cylindrical boxes attached to the sides of your electric poles, the average age of those transformers is 42 years. The average lifespan they were designed for is 40 years. And that's kind of tells you a lot, actually, about how the distribution network is set up right now. It's really old technology. It's a lot of stuff that's just been sort of fixed piecemeal as you go along, but not necessarily really upgraded in any huge way. And it has a big effect on what happens in communities when you start to lose different parts of this, because it's hard to reroute around one chunk if it goes out in some cases.
It sounds like I'm hearing between the lines of what you're saying, Maggie Carruth-Baker, is it's time for governments, municipalities, states, whomever, to open up the wallet. It sounds like there's going to have to be some money put into the grid.
There absolutely has to be, yeah. And part of the problem is that right now we don't have a really good system of incentives for who should be in charge of that. You know, in the past 30 or 40 years, we've really changed the way the electric industry works, and it's gone from being this big monopoly sort of thing to being much more deregulated, having a lot more different smaller players involved. And in some ways, it's been really good for customers, in terms of, you know, costs going down and things like that, mm-hmm. competition. But on the other hand, it sort of left you with this situation where there's not really anybody who feels like they have the incentive to pay attention to the long term. So people fix what needs to be fixed immediately, and they worry about keeping the costs low for their customers, but they don't necessarily worry about what's going to happen 20 or 30 years from now. And we don't really have a good incentive network in place to make sure anybody's paying attention to that.
So the challenge and the lesson from the blackout of 2003, in your view, is?
The challenge and the lesson is that we really need to update our grid. We have this 100-year-old technology that has kind of been grandfathered in, and it's getting to the point where we're going to need to change it because we're more dependent on it than we've ever been before. We need it more than we've ever needed it before. But nobody's paying as much attention to it as they need to be.
Maggie Kurth-Baker is a science columnist for the New York Times Magazine and science editor at BoingBoing.net and the author of Before the Lights Go Out, and she spoke to us today from Minneapolis. Maggie, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Still to come, Michigan's corrections budget is more than $2 billion, and new data shows Michigan prisoners serve longer sentences than in any other state. Long sentences and a bloated budget. We'll find out more next. And then many argue that sports is an economic driver in big cities. But does that really mean that now is the time for a new hockey arena in downtown Detroit? We ask that question coming up in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Prisoners in Michigan serve longer sentences than in any other state. That's according to a recent Pew study, which finds lengthy sentences have bloated the state's corrections budget. Michigan's corrections budget currently exceeds $2 billion. Meanwhile, the state sentencing guidelines have not been overhauled for 15 years. In response, the Michigan Law Review Commission has launched a bipartisan review to figure out just where Michigan stands in comparison to the rest of the nation and where reform might be needed. Joining us to talk about this is Russ Marlin. He's with the Michigan Department of Corrections, and he joins us from Lansing. And here in the studio, we're joined by Ann Yantis. She's a managing attorney for the State Appellate Defender's Office. It's good to have you both on the program.
Thank you, Cindy. It's great to be here.
Thanks, Cindy, for having me.
Can you give us, Ann, an idea of what was going on in 1998 to lead to these tough sentencing guidelines? What forces were at play?
Well, I think there was a sense that we needed to have more uniformity in sentences and less disparity among sentences. So there was a commission that was put into place, and there were 19 members. It was a pretty balanced commission that had several legislators, several judges, a prosecutor, defense attorney, victims' rights advocate, sheriff, director of the Department of Corrections.
So it was a very measured, studied thing. It wasn't knee-jerk, and a lot of different voices went into the conversation.
That's right, and that was important because the commission has the ability to tag people who are experts in sentencing law and to formulate policy for what the sentences should be. And the commission can be less prone to the political pressures that are in effect for the legislature. So they came up with recommendations. They looked at 700 felony offenses in Michigan, came up with recommended ranges. There was some guidance by the legislature, but there were a number of decisions made by the commission, and they try to balance everything out.
So I guess the question remains, Russ, why do you think these guidelines haven't been looked at or updated in 15 years?
Well, I think that's because the legislature did away with that commission shortly after they passed these guidelines. I think that they're at the time was probably a desire to review them, and I think that's what we're starting to do now. But you're right. I mean, we put a lot of time and effort into these guidelines, put them in place, and then never reviewed them in the last 15 years to see if they're doing what the Sentencing Commission had intended them to do, if we're realizing the outcomes as a state that we would like to see from them. So I think this is an important step to take a look at them.
And looking back at the 15 years, Ann Yantas, have those sentencing guidelines made a difference in crime? Did being tough on crime pay off?
Well, I'm not sure that the crime rate has dropped dramatically, and I guess you would look at that because we seem to have – actually, we do have a large number of people in prison right now, and the increases have been primarily since the early 1980s, and the increase has been much greater than the rise in the state's population or the rise in crime generally. So we're incarcerating a large number of people. They have longer sentences now in Michigan for the average length of time that you serve. Our guidelines, in some respects, were harsher on violent crimes than the old guidelines had been. There had been a set of guidelines in effect before that from the courts, but these are legislative guidelines. They're a little tougher on violent crimes. But then in the 14 years since we've had these guidelines take effect in January of 99, the legislature has gone in and sort of on a piecemeal basis has increased the recommended ranges or moved crimes into higher crime categories.
So if anything, it's toughened them.
Yes.
And I'd like the thoughts of both of you. What have you both seen as the consequences of all of this and keeping offenders behind bars longer? I guess consequences both social and fiscal. Russ, let me start with you on that.
Well, you know, Ann was correct that we did see our prison population rise substantially from the early 90s all the way until we hit our all-time high in March of 2007 at 51,554. At that time, we were the fifth largest prison system in the country, only behind California, Texas, Florida, and New York. So we started doing what we could internally to take a look at prisoner reentry programs using risk assessment instruments, working with our parole board to see if there's ways that we couldn't take a look at our prison population and do a better job of transitioning them back to the community. And I think we've done a really good job of that, and subsequently our prison population has dropped now to 43,300 approximately. So I think we went from the fifth largest prison system to the eighth or ninth today. And so we've tried to do what we can internally, but I think when you talk to folks like these folks from Council of State Governments that are beginning work here in Michigan, mm-hmm. who are national experts in this field, they'll say that our sentencing structure is very unique. It's unlike virtually any other state. And because of that, a number of ways it's unique. And because of that, that's why we're seeing a higher length of stay in Michigan than the national average.
We're speaking with Ann Yantas. She's a managing attorney for the State Appellate Defender's Office, and talking with Russ Marlin, who's with the Michigan Department of Corrections. Russ, you talked about the fact that Michigan's sentencing guidelines are unique. Give us some ideas of how so. How is Michigan unique amongst other states?
Well, I think one of the primary things is, you know, most states, the way you're scored, you take a look at the crime you committed and the circumstances surrounding that crime and your criminal history, and you're given points for both of those areas, and like on a graph where those two points intersect is a range of months. And that determines, A, whether you'll go to prison or not, and B, how long, if you do go to prison, you'll go to prison. And most states, that is it's a line, the in-out decision, whether you go to prison or you stay local in a community-based sanction. What's unique to Michigan, we have this kind of gray area in the middle called straddle cells, where judges can either send someone to prison or sanction them with a community-based sanction. And so about 25% of all cases fall into that category, and they said that category in of itself is very unique across the country. And I think when you look at county-level data, you'll see some judges who send 70% of that category to prison. Some counties, some judges, it's 10%. So there's a huge disparity between judges and counties with the same crime, same criminal history, who goes to prison and who doesn't.
And it sounds like the very reason back doubling back to 1998 was to kind of even out the disparities that were deemed a problem back then by doing this. Ann, what did you want to?
Well, and I agree with Russ on that certainly you will have disparity if you have a wide range of discretion and judges are allowed to determine prison versus community placement without a lot of guidance there. But the other comment that some of the national groups have made about our guidelines, just starting to look at them now, is that they're much more complicated than the guidelines in other states, and that they also have a fair amount of double counting. So what they mean by that is our guidelines are set up so that they have 27 variables, and you receive points under each variable for certain aggravating factors. Now, our guidelines don't pick up any mitigating factors like maybe the federal system does.
Okay.
So you have only these aggravating factors, and you have a large number of variables. So you're picking up a lot of aggravating conduct, and then you have double counting. And, for example, if the offender has two prior felony convictions, there's a variable that picks up the number of prior convictions, and you'll receive points there. And then there's another variable that picks up whether you are still serving the sentence for one or both of those prior convictions. So you'll receive points there. Mm-hmm. And then there's a third variable that will pick up whether you have three or more felony offenses over a period of 5 years. So given the current offense and then the two prior convictions, you can get points there. And then to top it off, the prosecutor is allowed to file a notice of intent to enhance the sentence because the person is an habitual felony offender. So once they file that notice, which they do pretty much all the time, the judge is allowed to then increase that range that has already been increased by three different variables. Now they can increase it by another 50% because the person has two prior felony convictions.
Wow. Now, I would say, as you're talking about this, some folks would say that's all very harsh, and others would say it's all very fair. Is there an appetite in the state, in Lansing, or around the state of Michigan, do you think, to change these, to reform these guidelines?
Well, I will say this, that sentencing is not a science. There is no one number that is the right answer for any given crime or any given individual who commits that crime. So you really have to balance a lot of things. And I think right now we're at a point where we have got this huge prison population. Mm-hmm. We have people serving long sentences, and it doesn't seem to have dramatically improved the situation. So we're looking at ways to be more effective. And so we're looking to see are other states doing a better job and still protecting the public. I mean, I was looking this morning, and Minnesota has about 10,000 people in prison. We have 43,000 people. So, you know, there are potentially different ways to do this that are more effective.
And Russ, it strikes me that as people are being kept in prison longer, there's a much greater number of elderly or ill inmates.
That is true. We probably have a greater than average number of elderly and aging mm-hmm. inmates. And, you know, to your prior question, Cindy, mm-hmm. I think there's an appetite to look at it. You know, I don't know about if anyone has any ideas about how to change the guidelines right now. And that's what, you know, these folks from Council of State Governments, they have an outstanding national reputation for coming to states, evaluating their data, and recommending some good national best practices for states to use. They're working in a number of states right now. And I think this is kind of a national movement to take a look at corrections, criminal justice policy, and try to be smart on crime. You know, we're as you mentioned, people have differing views on this. And I think you talk to some prosecutors and they'll say, yeah, you can talk about, you know, Minnesota and other states, but they don't have, you know, four of the top 10 most violent cities in the country, Saginaw, Flint, Pontiac, and Detroit. So, you know, they'll tell you that there's some uniqueness here in Michigan that causes the situation that we're in.
Well, there are two things we have to look at in terms of sentence reform. One is the length of the minimum sentence of the individual coming into the prison system. And that's a factor that's determined by the judge. And the sentencing guidelines will help to determine that sentence. And in Michigan, you cannot be released early before you serve the minimum sentence. So that's the first part of the equation. Mm-hmm. But the second part of the equation is the parole board and the parole discretion. Because in Michigan, unlike a number of states, we have both a minimum and a maximum sentence. Some states just have a single number. And in Michigan, the parole board has jurisdiction of the individual after they finish the minimum sentence up to the maximum sentence. And the maximum sentences can be much longer than the minimum. So, for example, if someone writes a bad check, takes it to the bank and tries to cash it, they can be convicted of an offense that has, by law, a 14-year maximum penalty. The judge might send them to prison for 2 years on the minimum term, and the parole board has them for 12 years, and they get to decide when they are released. And if people are held much longer than their minimum term, that creates this larger prison population. Mm. And then it also goes into the fact that, you know, we have average longer minimum sentence stays, not sentence length, but stays than other states. So you have to look at both parts of the equation.
And when you think of the fact that the Michigan Law Review and Commission is looking now at these sentencing guidelines, who's on this commission?
Well, there's some legislators and there's some folks from the public, but there, you know, there's folks from the it's a body that's contained in the legislative section of Michigan's government. So, and the legislators that are on there, I know, are very familiar with correctional issues. They've sat on our Appropriations Committee. Most of the ones are pretty familiar with this area, but I don't think that the members of the Law Revision Commission are going to do the analysis. I think we've brought in these outside experts. We're already giving them 5 years worth of data. They're going to analyze that data, and then they're the ones that are going to be coming to the Law Revision Commission with some recommendations for policy changes here, probably in another year.
That's what I was wondering. So is there kind of a timetable at work, or is it fairly flexible?
Well, you know, it's going to take them a while to analyze the data, talk to folks within the criminal justice system here in Michigan. So probably sometime next year, I think we could expect some results of that analysis and maybe some policy recommendations.
And finally, are we seeing social attitudes towards crime and punishment changing in Michigan?
Well, I think that there's some recognition that longer sentences don't necessarily rehabilitate the offender any more than maybe a slightly shorter sentence. When it comes to juvenile offenders, what I see is a really interesting tension between the fact that there's a sense that juvenile offenders are more dangerous, that they're more likely to offend and maybe more likely to be violent. And if you look at risk assessment instruments that just predict based on where you fall within a group and how the group is likely to act, mm-hmm. youth correlates fairly, it has a higher correlation with recidivism. So young offenders will score high on these risk assessment instruments. And so if you just use that for sentencing, you would say, well, we should give this person a very harsh sentence. And those instruments actually were not designed to make the sentencing decision. But the U.S. Supreme Court has said three times now that juvenile offenders are less culpable and less blameworthy than adults. And they said that because juvenile offenders, their character is less formed, they're more easily influenced by peers and family. Parts of their brain have not completely developed in terms of risk assessment and looking at the consequences of their behavior. And even their environment, they have less control over the environment they're in than adults. So they're less culpable. So on the one hand, you know, maybe they score out as higher risk, but they're less culpable. And so I think that when you're sentencing that type of individual, you have to look at that both sides of the coin, because if you give the person, say, an extra 10 years because they, you know, you view them as high risk, if you're going from maybe a 20-year minimum to a 30-year minimum, maybe we're shooting ourselves in the foot by giving that extra 10 years, because that juvenile is going to outgrow those risk factors in probably 5, maximum 10 years. So giving them an extra 10 years doesn't really accomplish anything. And we need to look at what we're doing with juvenile offenders.
Russ, your thoughts?
Well, I think you're right, Cindy. I think that across the nation, and I think in part fueled by some of the budget issues that states have had across the country, people are looking at corrections policy, sentencing guidelines, to see if they're getting that return on investment of tax dollars and enhanced public safety. I think what's unique in this time we're in now is that there's a lot of data out there, and you can get the data very, very quickly across this country on what states are doing that's working, what's not working. So I think, and you're also seeing other groups. You know, here in Michigan we have the business leaders of Michigan, the Detroit Chamber of Commerce, have taken official positions on corrections reform issues, primarily for the budget implications involved. I mean, you know, you take a look at our history in the state, and you haven't had business folks involved in corrections policy before. So it's a very unique time. It's an interesting time, but, you know, it's an exciting time because I think we're seeing the opportunity to really enhance our criminal justice system here and use our tax dollars most effectively for the citizens of Michigan.
Ann Yantis is a managing attorney for the State Appellate Defender's Office. Russ Marlin is with the Michigan Department of Corrections. And thanks to both of you for joining us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Yes, thank you very much, Cindy.
Still to come, there's been quite a bit of buzz about building a new hockey arena in downtown Detroit. But our next guest doesn't quite buy the hype. We'll have that conversation coming up next. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, the irony was certainly not lost on many when, just about the time the city of Detroit filed for bankruptcy protection, Governor Snyder gave the green light to a new arena for the Detroit Red Wings, an arena to be located just immediately north of downtown. Plans are calling for an 18,000-seat state-of-the-art arena and accompanying entertainment district. It will be funded with a mix of $365.5 million in private investment and an estimated public investment of somewhere in the neighborhood of $284 million. Now, the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation's predicting the new Wings Arena and the mixed-use district could create about 8,300 jobs. And it predicts a statewide economic impact in the neighborhood of $1.8 billion. Well, my next guest would like to challenge the statement that a new sports arena can energize a financially depleted city and boost its morale. Marvin Serkin is a specialist in comparative urban politics and co-author of the book Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, and he joins us now from New York City. Welcome, Marvin.
Welcome. Thanks a lot.
Whenever we hear of a new sports stadium or an arena being announced, I don't care what the city, we do hear that similar message. Hey, more jobs, great economic impact for the area. And to that you say?
I say, I love to hear magic being broadcast and told that it's going to happen this time. It may not have been that way the last time before, but this is the time we've got the magic bullet that's going to make it work. And I'm going to laugh a little bit with it, but I say, gee, I wish it were true, and maybe it will be true this time, but I haven't seen it really happen in the past.
And certainly
I haven't seen it happen in Detroit.
Because the Wings, this new Wings home would, of course, join Comerica Park, the Tigers home, and Ford Field, the Lions home. And by the way, we don't want to forget, the new publicly funded Red Wings home replaces the old publicly funded Red Wings home, which we all know is Joe Louis Arena. So you're saying you haven't seen that pay off with any of this?
Well, I really haven't seen it. And, you know, it's the corporate elite in this country seems to have the idea that they can keep selling the old remedies, and that the old remedies, the new time around, either people are going to forget that they were promised this the time before, that this was the remedy that was going to be produce the magic bullet to make it all work, or either people have forgotten, or that they just never even heard it in the first place. So they keep drumming this up again, and somehow sports and gambling casinos and big hotel centers like Renaissance Center, downtown Detroit, and Detroit has had a history of being promised these great adventures that are going to really, make the city work the way it's supposed to work, and it hasn't seemed like it's worked in the past. So I'm wondering how this tremendous insurge of public funds, in addition to private funds, is going to do more than just create a boondoggle for the private interests.
And when they talk about the economic impact of $1.8 billion for the state and the 8,300 jobs, let's talk about the jobs, first of all. In your opinion, of the kinds of jobs created by a sports arena in construction and then afterward?
Yeah, well, one of the things you have to think about when you do this, when you see these kinds of contracts that go out, and that is to say, what percentage of the workforce that's going to be employed in the construction is going to be your local workforce? And the contracts usually require that a certain percentage of the workforce will be local. And the second part of that would be, what percentage of the workforce is going to be not only local, but union and local, or union altogether? And we've got to deal with those issues in order to really see what the impact on the city is going to be, because the numbers may look terrific, but if the numbers really take your funds that are generated outside of the city, then how is it really going to help the city? That's the bottom line question.
And then the type of jobs once this arena is built and the Red Wings are playing through the season?
Yeah, well then, you know, jobs parking cars and jobs selling, you know, hamburgers and hot dogs and beer at the stadium are not generally going to be highly skilled, highly paid jobs. We're not looking at a tremendous influx of jobs. What you then look at is what's projected is all of the services that are going to be around an arena, like the creation of restaurants and hotels and other cafes and other activities that will create jobs that will be around the arena. Now, there's no question that there's going to be some of that that's going to get generated. The question is, if you're dealing with the city of Detroit, we've got this tremendous unemployment problem where wages are going down, wages are being depressed in the jobs that are being created, for example, at Chrysler at the Jefferson plant, where they're now the new contracts do a two-tiered employment scale, in which the new employment is $12 an hour less than the old scale was. Then you're looking at not raising the salary and raising the income level, but in fact either continuing to keep it stagnant or lowering it. So the question would be: are they going to generate more higher incomes, which are then going to generate, and without seeing really production go on in a large scale, you're seeing services go on, and you're seeing a relatively small number of people being employed and relatively small incomes being generated.
Can you give us a for instance of in another city where the promise was made and it wasn't met?
Well, I happen to be talking to you from New York City, and you've heard of the New York Yankees, of course.
Of course.
Well, the New York Yankees had this great ball stadium, one of the classics, 1927 Yankee Stadium. And about 15, 20 years ago, they came up with a plan, public and private plan, to refurbish the great old Yankee Stadium. Because this was not only going to maintain Yankee Stadium, but it was going to help to regenerate the Bronx. And they put it something in the neighborhood of $100 million, which, you know, 15, 20 years ago was a substantial amount of money.
Yeah.
And, well, 20 years later, they decided, no, this isn't quite good enough. Let's tear down the old Yankee Stadium. Let's put $1 billion into building a new Yankee Stadium, and this is going to resuscitate the Bronx. Well, the stadiums have been built and have been destroyed. And it still, of course, hasn't really resuscitated the Bronx. And this is happening again right now in Queens, where you have the new Citi Field, which replaced the old Shea Stadium at the cost of practically $1 billion. And the new plan is to take the existing small-scale businesses in the neighborhood around Citi Field, where the New York Mets play baseball, and tear it completely down and build a whole new city of cafes and restaurants and walking streets and hotels around the area of the stadium. And at the same time, of course, to remove or replace the small-scale businesses, which will lose out because they'll be moved out. Hmm. So, you know, there are examples here that you could go on from city after city where stadiums are built and the plan is to create something vast and modern and marvelous, but the magic bullet still simply has not exactly had that kind of production because a lot of these stadiums, one of the things that they do is that they serve corporate needs on a number of angles because, one, they're able to use public funds in the investment and at the same time provide private needs. Because one, the rationale for building these stadiums is to build these special, classy skyboxes and special facilities.
The big money makers
are owned or condominiumized or rented by large corporations at fairly large cost, and so this generates money for the operation and provides interest for the corporation, but doesn't provide a tremendous amount of jobs or employment or income.
Well, let me ask you, if an owner says, well, fine, I don't get the help with the new arena that I need those skyboxes, I need to pay those salaries and stay competitive, and if I don't get it, I'll move the team somewhere where I will get that public funding.
Exactly, in the same way I'll move the company, and if I can't produce cars here and make more money, I'll take it and produce cars somewhere else and make more money. And so goes the story, and part of the story of Detroit, which includes this new Red Wings concept of the stadium, is are we going to see the city further abandoned, or are we going to see the city supported, including supporting its population, including supporting its workforce, including supporting its neighborhoods? And thus far, what we have seen is a continuation of abandonment and magic solutions like new stadium, which in fact have not served the problem of really providing the needs that the city has.
And what I think I hear you saying is, so if the Red Wings move from Joe Louis Arena just the way that the Tigers move from Tiger Stadium and right. the Lions move from the Silver Dome and everybody's together in Foxtown, it's not necessarily creation of jobs, because those Joe Louis jobs are just going to move up Woodward Avenue a mile or two.
They're just going to move. Exactly right. And, you know, part of the rationale for the new Red Wing Stadium is that it's going to be downtown Detroit. And if you know how the city is structured, the Joe Louis Arena is downtown Detroit.
On the river.
It's a little too far away, because it's far away from Comerica Stadium, mm-hmm. and it's not where they want to emphasize the new development. And we could talk a lot more, but you know what people like Dan Gilbert are doing in terms of bringing corporations into Detroit, in terms of bringing actually that level of interest into the city, and the idea of sports and the idea of conventions is very attractive to them.
Let me ask you this. We saw Tiger Stadium torn down, and then, of course, once the Lions moved out of the Pontiac Silverdome, it sat empty and just sucked down scarce resources from that cash-strapped city through the years. What do you foresee happening to Joe Louis Arena once the Wings move up Woodward Avenue to Foxtown?
Yeah, become run down, become second rate, or become torn down.
And it was the new silver bullet in 1980, wasn't
exactly.
it?
And it's still used, and it's still very successful. I mean, the Joe Louis Arena has been a very successful, and the Red Wings have been a very successful sports franchise.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, you don't have to necessarily leave Detroit, and you don't necessarily have to have those fancy skyboxes in order to create not only a profitable enterprise, but a socially useful enterprise. And that, I think, is what we really need to look at. And we look at things like we need to look at not just what one specific item can do to generate solutions, but look at the overall perspective and see how a package of a plan, a real urban strategy, can really look at redevelopment and urban redevelopment for a city like Detroit. And I don't see that's going on with the stadium. It's not. It's like a one-shot deal. This is the magic bullet, and it's not an overall strategy.
Marvin, do you feel like a voice crying in the wilderness? Because I'm sure, you know, seeing Governor Snyder support this, and Mike Ilitch has certainly been a powerful mover for a lot of good. The Foxtown area has been renovated and has had new life breathed into it because he moved the Little Caesars headquarters right there in the Foxtown area. Pieces are coming together. This is happening not just in Detroit, but all over the nation. Do you feel like a voice crying in the wilderness?
Well, sometimes I say that's true. I do feel like a little voice crying in the wilderness. On the other hand, I think it's important to see, to really look at the analysis, because if you analyze it and you show the public that there is a way of understanding what's going on, it isn't just a shot in the wilderness. The people who are doing this plan, they understand the long-term benefits that are going to be gained by it. And the long-term benefits that they see gained by it are not necessarily the long-term benefits for the city and its population.
Marvin Serkin, a specialist in comparative urban politics and social change, and also co-author of the book Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, and he was kind enough to join us today from New York City. Marvin, thank you so very much for talking with us.
Cindy, it was great.
Okay, let's continue in the sports vein. Quick, what comes to mind when you think of women playing baseball?
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
That's Tom Hanks as manager Jimmy Dugan in the 1992 film A League of Their Own. Well, there is a women's softball team in West Michigan who would be more than happy to show Jimmy Dugan they don't cry and they can play. Joining us now is Lynn Schweibert. Lynn has been playing on the same team in West Michigan with three other women for the past 4 decades. Welcome to the program, Lynn.
Thank you very much. I'm honored.
And we're joined by her daughter, Leslie Rymick. She plays on the team with her mom. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Cindy.
So, Lynn, you play second base. You are 79 years young. How did you and the three other originals come together? You joined with Kathleen Ponence and Donna McConnell and Sharon Vanderwood, and you decided we're playing softball. Why was that?
Well, actually, the three of them were at a newcomers meeting, and they said, we got to find something to do for the summer. And I was also there, but at a different table. And that's how it came about 40 years ago. And actually, that night I found my OB doctor, my veterinarian, and my dentist, and my softball team. And all three are retired, except the softball team.
You're still at it.
We're still at it.
You've had four decades of playing softball. And Leslie, you've been on the team with your mom for, what, 35 years? What did you learn from playing softball with your mom?
That it's very hard to keep up with her. No, we have just had a lot of great experiences. Boy, to culminate one experience that I've learned from her is just life is fun. And she has embraced that through everything that she does, whether it be softball, her job. And I just have tried to incorporate that in my life as well, to just enjoy life, have fun, and be blessed with what you have and what you can do.
Lynn, when you and Kathleen and Donna and Sharon stop and go, wow, we've been doing this for 40 years, did you have any clue when you first got together that you'd be able to say that four decades later?
Not in my wildest dreams. I can remember my father, who's been gone a long time, and I was probably in my 50s, and he said, Lynn, it's time you really stop. I don't want you to get hurt out there. And I thought about it. I said, oh, Dad, no problem. So here I am still, and I hope so much to go a little bit further, but I don't want to be a hindrance to the team. But not in our wildest dreams did we think we'd go this far.
I think it does say a lot when I consider, as we were saying, you're 79, you've been playing for 40 years. And are you a pretty good second baseman, Lynn? She can hold her
out. I started out at third base, then moved from third base to shortstop to first base. Now I'm at second base. I don't have a heck of a throwing arm anymore, but I can run. I can run.
And Lynn, over these 40 years you've played, can you give us some of your best moments?
Well, it's hard to recap. There's a lot. But if I may throw in two, I would like to say, obviously, playing with my daughter for 35 years and playing with my granddaughter, having three generations. Yeah. I had some tachycardia that year just thinking about it, of how wonderful, what a joy in my life that I never thought I would ever see. And then I have to say, probably one time for about 2 or 3 years, Leslie's husband, Dick, was our coach. And he had his wife, his sister Diane, and his mother-in-law, Lynn, on the team. And he made it to this day. He's still out there laughing
still
about
with
it,
us
I'm
all.
Sure.
Thanks so much to both of you for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Cindy,
thank you so
for
much,
asking.
Cindy.
It's a real pleasure and an honor.
We've been talking with Lynn Schweibert. Lynn has been on the same team, softball team in West Michigan, with three other friends for the past four decades, and joined by her daughter, Leslie Rymick, who has been playing on the team with her mom for the last 35 years. And the only time they say they cry is when it is off season and they cannot be out on the field playing softball. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk tomorrow at 3:00.